WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Today marks the 40th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court ruling that brought an end to the legal segregation of the nation's public schools. This ruling changed the law, but actual integration didn't always go so smoothly. 3 years after the Brown decision, 9 black students were chosen to attend the all-white Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. Not only were many white citizens violently opposed to it, but Arkansas's governor, Orville Faubus, called out the Arkansas National Guard to prevent the black students from entering the school. It wasn't until President Eisenhower sent in the 101st Airborne 2 weeks later that they were able to start classes at the school. Melba Beals was one of those black students. She's written a memoir called Warriors Don't Cry about her junior year at Central High. Beals was 13 when the Brown versus the Board of Education ruling was issued. She told me her teacher sent the students home early that day for fear of reprisals.
On that day, I was walking home from school, and I always walked across this persimmon field. It was a field where these mushy persimmons were, and it was kind of like a vacant lot in the neighborhood that I lived in. And I was walking across the field, and this man approached, and he's, you know, I first hear this voice at the end, and he's there, and he makes an effort to rape me. And the only way I got away was because one of the older girls who had up to that time really tortured me came through that field, or came that way, and rescued me by hitting him on the back of the head and on the back.
And this was a white man.
Yes, it was. And he said, you know, as he was doing this, he said, I'll teach you people to want to go to school with my kids. You know, you can't do that. You can't be free. You can't do this, you know. And those nigger-loving Supreme Court judges, I'll show them. So he was just really vile, and it was because of the Brown versus Topeka decision. And, you know, as a result of that, I decided that I was going to spend a nickel and read the newspaper all the time so that I could keep up with what was going on, so that when the white people were angry at me, I would know it and I could do something about it.
You write that by the age of 3, you were already afraid of white people.
Sure. Describe
the racial climate in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're talking about the 40s and the 50s.
Really frightening. The thing that struck me was that a lot of the adults always talked about white people and what they wanted and what they thought they should do to make it all right. And a few years just before that, there had been a man who'd been hanged in our church. And so I was really frightened of the talk. Just the talk made me uneasy. And then when we would go out, like downtown, out of our own little reservation, it was the encounters. We'd be walking down a path, and my mother would have to step aside. And we would always keep our head lowered. Mother would always say, "Don't look up, don't look up," you know. And that's frightened me. And I just felt that they were the boss, that they had all the power, that I couldn't do anything, that there was no way out for me, that I didn't possess any ability to determine what I was going to do.
Now, when you were 16 years old, this was after Brown versus the Board of Education, and a teacher in your school said, how many of you would like to go to Central High School in Little Rock, an all-white school? You raised your hand. Why?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, my mother had integrated, been one of the first blacks to go to the University of Arkansas. And that had been a very trying experience. So I want to say right off the bat, I understood what it meant to integrate. But mother's trying experience was people frowning. Hers was like kind of chit-chat at the dinner table and heartbreaking stuff, and it made her sad. But in no way did I conceive of any physical violence.
And yet you didn't tell your family?
No.
Why not?
Because, you know, somewhere in me I knew that this was a stretch, that I was walking across a line that maybe I ought to have consulted them about. But I didn't really ever expect, kind of I expected and kind of I didn't, that it would happen, you know? I mean, for us to get that opportunity to go was like at that point a distant possibility, not anything that was immediate. And so I just kind of mumbled to myself about it. Yes, I ought to go home and tell Grandma, but I didn't, because then they'd have this big discussion. They might make me take my name off, you know? So I just didn't. And I just thought, you know, okay, I'm going to write my name. Nothing's going to happen.
And their reaction when you did finally tell them?
they were aghast. I mean, as I described, you know, they circled me like covered wagons circling for the attack of the Indians. And they all, you know, jumped on me. And they, you know, what did you do this for? Why didn't you tell us? Are you out of your mind?
They were afraid of for your safety. Or they were afraid
of... It wasn't even that. They had no concept that Little Rock people would be that violent because they had not been really, except for a few hangings now and then, excuse me, they had not been that group violence was not a big thing in Little Rock. They hanged people individually for things that they thought were horrifying up to then. But there wasn't any sign that people got into mobs and did uglies. And the buses had been integrated without a traumatic kind of incident. And so the anticipation was that there would be this short little foray, and then we'd go about our business, you know.
Did you feel, though, that once you decided to integrate Little Rock Central High School, that you had to be perfect, you had to be a model student, even above and beyond the kind of perfection that your family asked from you?
Without question. Because the white people, we were always told they were better than we, and they were smarter than we were. And I remember my friends saying to me, you know, you can't perspire. You can't sweat. Because if you sweat, you know, all white people don't sweat. And a lot of my friends were telling me things I had to do. Everybody, you know, became then the advice giver. Everybody we ran into, whether at church, on the way to the grocery store, at the mailman, everybody we ran into became, don't go to, the, you know, advice givers. Some would say, you know, don't be too uppity now. You can't go to that school. And others would say what I had to do to get along. You got to wear certain clothes. You got to change the look of your hair. I had long hair, had in a ponytail. Gosh, you got to go on a diet. You can't wear those saddle shoes. And, you know, so like my grandmother and mother were sewing like mad. My mother was sewing clothes. And because we were poor, we didn't have a lot of money. And I remember a time when my dresses were made of flour socks bleached. So we didn't have a lot, but Mama was sewing because she could make things. And so we were getting ready for this because we had to be as good as we could be because we've been told all our lives that they were better than we were.
We're speaking today with Melba Beals, and she's written a book called Warriors Don't Cry, and it's about the efforts to integrate Little Rock Central High School, and she was one of the first 9 black students to integrate that school. Tell us then about the first day. This was September 1957. Mm-hmm. You and your mother got in the car, drove up to Little Rock Central High School.
Yeah.
Describe what you saw when you got there.
Well, we first heard the noise approaching it. We heard noise, and we heard there were people walking on the sidewalk towards the school. The gathering, for whatever reason, was there because we were coming, because by that time, white people had begun to make it very clear that they didn't want us to go. But it became clear to me that this was a bigger than I had imagined horror when we walked up behind this mob who was gathering across the street from the school, and their focused attention was on Elizabeth Eckford. And across the street directly in front of Central High School, there were the Arkansas members of the Arkansas National Guard.
And Elizabeth was one of the other students.
She was one. Elizabeth Eckford was one of the 9 students. And she was walking along this ring of guardsmen trying to penetrate, trying to enter. Because by this time we knew, because of one of our spies, and because I think Mrs. Bates even drove over there the night before, we knew that Vabas had ringed the school with guards. We knew that very well.
He was
well.
The governor.
He was the governor of Little Rock, of Arkansas, and we knew that those guards had been dispatched. What we hypothesized was that those guards might be there to keep the peace, to protect the property, to not maybe help us enter, but certainly to keep anybody from getting us as we entered. So when I saw Elizabeth walk this line and try to get through, and every time she'd try to get through, they would close ranks on her, it was a surprise to me. And it was a horror to me because at first all this attention is focused on her. We're going to hang her, get the nigger, get her. And then as that goes on, we're standing there trying to figure out, well, how do we get to Elizabeth? What do? We can't see anybody else in sight. We couldn't see the other people because later on we would learn they were down at the end of the block, the group, the core of the group. And so my mom and I were talking about what can we do? And we realized we can't do anything. And then it occurred to my mother that if we went over to stand with Elizabeth, we might endanger her more than if we went the other way. So we determined that we were in trouble. We got to get out of here.
Well, I had assumed that the crowd would have figured out why you were there.
Well, sure. But you know, at first, it was kind of a milling kind of thing. And they didn't maybe know that we were exactly there for that. At first, their total attention is focused on Elizabeth, who was entering their school. It was the most riveting thing to see this small girl, petite girl, walk this line of armed soldiers, trying to get past them, thinking they're going to let her in at a certain point, believing that maybe she's at the wrong point and should go in at another one, and them closing their ranks every time she made that turn. And at the same time, there begins to collect this crowd on her heels, just sniping at her and growling at her and barking at her, calling her names and reaching out for her. Well, you know, the crowd is at first also riveted by the sight. And the sight of this is churning their anger and churning their rage. And so they're watching her. They're not watching us, really. And only after a little while did a few of the people directly around us say, hey, we don't have to go over there. We got a Senegal to hang right here.
What happened to Elizabeth that day?
Benjamin Fine, a reporter from the New York Times, a white reporter from the New York Times, and Mrs. Grace Lorch, a white woman, stepped up beside her, even in the midst of that mob, and guided her to the bus and got her out safely. Without them, she'd be dead.
And you and your mother fled back to your car.
We fled back to our car. We got away harried. My mother's blouse was torn. Of course, we're very harried. And the men who were after us with a rope almost did catch us, but for the grace of God, they fell. One guy fell over a limb. The others fell over him. So we were able to make our escape. I in the driver's seat. Mother was in the passenger seat for some unknown reason. She'd been teaching me how to drive in the parking lot at the grocery store as kind of a fluke. We don't know why. But she decided that, I guess, because I was talking about getting my license when I got a little bit older. But I had been practicing intensely, just really yearning to drive. And I knew how to drive then a little bit, not totally. But I was the one who got to the car first. Mother had given me the keys and said, get out of here. Get out of here now. And when I wouldn't go, she slapped me. And I knew we were in trouble because my mother never, ever slapped me, ever. Because she said to slap a body was to attack the human spirit. So you never hit somebody in the face for any reason.
Did you have second thoughts that day when you realized what you were truly up against?
Second thoughts does not nearly describe my situation that day. I went home. I get home. My grandmother's pulled all the shades and she's slammed the door. She's got chairs up against the doors because now, by now, the black community has heard about this incident. And we get home and grandma's just hysterical and mama's, you know, determined that we're not going to go back. And my father is absolutely adamant. That's it. Pack this kid up and ship her to Cincinnati, Ohio. And
get her out of here.
Get her out of here. And the community now, by then, is up in arms. We can't go anywhere or do anything. And our lives became, we were in a much greater prison than we ever were.
The President of the United States got involved in the standoff in Little Rock.
Well, yes. We go in. It's known as Mob Monday. We go into Central High School. And as we are dropped off by members of the NAACP and certain friends, we notice that there's a major mob going on, no, without question. And as we get out of the car, they roar, you know, louder. And we're like equivalent to probably 3/4 of a block distance from them, and maybe half block, going in the side door of Central High School. We get in there, and we can only stay till about 11:30. You know, inside the school, I'm spat upon, kicked, that kind of thing. Some adult mothers are in that school that day. And we are screeched at, but we get to class. And by about 11:30 that day, somebody comes to my class and fetches me to the office and says, we got to get out of there. And while they're collecting us in a room, we hear a man say that the mob is just the school's under siege. And maybe they're going to have to let one of us hang while they get the other 8 out. So that provoked Eisenhower to send, the next day we didn't go to school, of course, and then that provoked by that Wednesday Eisenhower to send the 101st. And he sent the 101st Guard to Little Rock.
So when you marched through the front door, which you did under the watchful eye of the 101st Airborne, did that feel like a victory to you, or was it just too early, to tell?
It was just astounding, you know, because I said, this is why we salute the flag. I am an American. It's going to be okay, you know. This is fine.
Even after all that, you felt,
hey, you know, we're in here. We're in this front door. This is where none of my people. I say in the book, my favorite sentence is, we walked up to the front door, up to where none of my people had ever been before, a student.
So it did feel like a victory.
Yes. Oh, yes. It felt like, this is it. We've reached our summit. Things are cool.
Melba Beals is our guest today on Fresh Air. Her book is called Warriors Don't Cry, and it's about 1957 when she was 16 years old, and in the 11th grade she was one of nine black students to integrate Little Rock Central High School. Her book is about her experiences and those times. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Melba Beals today and reminiscing about 1957 when she and nine other black students were the first to integrate Little Rock, Arkansas Central High School. Now, you were given a bodyguard, a fella named Danny, and it was his job to stick right by you. He used to stand outside the classrooms and make sure that you got from one class to the next and defend you against the kind of assaults that you took. Tell us, even with a bodyguard, what you had to put up with in the halls and in the classrooms at Central High.
Well, sure. The 101st were told that they could. There were certain parameters around the way they could guard us, and they were told that they were to try and avoid confrontations with those students. And so, you know, there were committees of kids who get together. Today, my left heel is injured from their getting together and walking on my heels. And you just couldn't get rid of them.
Speed and they would walk they behind you, right?
They walk behind you. Directly behind you. Speed it up, they speed it up. And they were good. They'd trade off. And it was just a killer, you know, because I'd go home with skinned heels and they'd get my bone and they'd kick you in the shin bone and the stomach, knock you over, knock you down flights of stairs, throw sticks of dynamite at you.
Which they did. They threw at you.
Yeah, right? Put stuff in your seat to sit on. Acid in my eye, acid-like substance in my eye, which burned my clothes, and I ended up having to wear glasses as a result of that right then. And the main thing was the, you know, the absolute degradation of my human spirit to have me sit in a room at 15 to talk all around me, but not to talk to me. You know, one of the things about being in Central High School as a black person was I was lonely. Very, very lonely. Days went by when I would like for somebody just to say to me, "Hi, how are you? Just talk to me." There'd be hours that I wouldn't say anything to anybody. And they'd have like pep rallies and they'd be pounding and sometimes I would applaud and I would try to get the rhythm of what they were doing and they would be so ugly about it, you know. If I happened to look somebody in the eye or happened to smile about a joke that I heard or something that was said, they'd be abusive about that. You know, they'd turn and say, "What are you talking about, nigger? What are you doing?" So there was that kind of constant and continuous attack of my human spirit.
Well, now, did your mother and your grandmother, who you lived with, did they know that every day for you was like going to battle?
Or did you? Not really. They did not know the depth and breadth of what was going on. They didn't totally understand. They knew it was really difficult by the change in my demeanor. And they knew it was hard. My grandmother especially. At one point in the book, I write about going to my grandmother and telling her, you know, I kind of want to die. Mm-hmm. But it was like a kind of. I didn't like actually have it figured out that I was going to commit suicide. I just wanted to die. I thought maybe I could bargain with God and go to sleep for a while and wake up in the summer. And my grandmother was wonderful because she looked at me and she said, "Good idea."
You know, she did.
"Great idea. How'd you plan to do it?" And then she turned back. She kept dusting the dining room table, you know. And she was so matter of fact. She said, "Now I can just see this headline now. You know, the white folks will have a big party in Robinson Auditorium and celebrate. And it'll be a big headline that you failed to complete your task, you know." And I mean, she really sobered me up with her talk about what I thought I wanted to do. So I couldn't tell my mother and my grandmother the real truth. I couldn't even verbalize the real truth until I was an adult. I could not verbalize the total truth until I wrote this book. I couldn't tell anybody how I felt. Only the other eight people who were there really knows how I felt. And they, I've talked to a couple of them who are really pleased that finally the true story came out, because the white people who were in charge painted a different picture. Oh, it's a little inconvenient for them, but they're getting along just fine.
Melba Beals is our guest. Her book is called Warriors Don't Cry, and it's about her attempts and her success in integrating Little Rock Central High School. She was one of the first nine black students to integrate that particular high school. Now, you had one more year at Central High, 1958.
Well, in the spring, in the September of 1958, Governor Orville Faubus closed the schools.
For how long?
For a year.
For a whole year.
Until we could go through the courts again. So I'm stuck at home by myself. In that year, in October of that year, my grandmother, who is absolutely my heart, dies, who had been my pal, my partner through this whole thing, dies very suddenly of leukemia. I'm at home by myself. My mother's going to school. We are now pariahs in the black community because as he's closing the schools, the white people who wanted segregation are also squeezing the life out of the black community, taking away businesses, denying loans, hitting suppliers, firing maids who worked in hotels, firing maids who worked in their kitchens, doing everything they could to convince us that it would be best not to go back.
So how did you get a senior year of high school?
At the end of that year, the NAACP, we were having trouble. We couldn't go out because we were threatened physically. And at the end of that year, we had repeatedly seen flyers and we'd heard rumors that the Ku Klux Klan was offering 10,000 dead and 5,000 alive, which was kind of an incentive in 1957. That was a lot of money. And in Little Rock, it was a lot more money. So the NAACP sent out word that they wanted safe houses or homes for all of us to go to. And so we packed our bags, and Ernie was already in Michigan State, and we went 8 different ways. I came to California, and the others went all the other cities that they went to. We were taken in by families. I was fortunate enough to be taken in by Dr. and Mrs. George McCabe, Carol and George, Mom and Pop, who live in Montgomery, California. That's a town not far from San Francisco, about 45 minutes from San Francisco, near Santa Rosa. He was a psychology professor at San Francisco State University. So here, God gave me this incredible blessing because these people were phenomenal.
You finished high school in California
with
this white family. Mm-hmm. How, when you think back about what happened in Little Rock and what happened in 1957, how do you think about those times now?
With pain. Less pain since I've written the book. The book writing was cathartic for me because I cried for a couple of years and that got the pain out. Up to then, I'd been, you know, it was sort of in concrete in my soul, in my gut. And I was sort of pretending that everything was okay, and it wasn't at all okay. And the pain was definitely there. And when I think back on Little Rock now, I can think back to that time with a much clearer view, with love. It was an incident which would shape the whole rest of my life.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much, Melba Beals, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Melba Beals' memoir about integrating Little Rock Central High School is entitled Warriors Don't Cry. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.